Who were your musical influences?
I listened to a lot of female singer-songwriters when I was very young, as a teenager. The Carly Simon, Joni Mitchell, Joan Armatrading, all the sort of post-Woodstock female singer-songwriters. And I liked the song, the form of the popular song very much. And I was, as soon as I could play any instrument, which was the guitar, was my first instrument, I started, writing songs that were kind of mimicking what I was listening to.
How about some of the women's music, movement artists?
Yes, and then when I was a little bit older, when I moved to San Francisco, a friend turned me on to women's music, a lesbian friend of mine. It was right around the time that Holly Near released her Imagine My Surprise album, and she had come out, and there was a lot of excitement about this music and about having music that really spoke to our lives as gay and lesbian people. I listened to Holly a lot in those days. Meg Christian, Chris Williamson, Margie Adam, they were all songwriters whom I admired very much.
Okay, they were women's music. Do you think that kind of led you to try and make a place for men's music, gay men's music?
Absolutely, yeah. I had had the idea before, even before I got to San Francisco, because I wanted to be a songwriter and make my living making records and touring. And it had occurred to me that because the gay movement was very important to me, that maybe somehow that, you know, I could merge that. And I didn't see any other men doing it. I had heard of, have you ever heard of an album called Caravan Tonight by Stephen Grossman?
Yes, I have many copies of it.
Yeah, it's a great album, and it was released, it was so far ahead of its time. I had heard that album, and I was very excited by that. But when I got to the Bay Area, I didn't really see anybody else doing it, and I think it was after I went to see Holly Near for the first time that I started to look for other men who might be interested in creating music that spoke to our lives as gay men. And in fact, I in the summer of 1981, I put an ad in the Bay Area Music Magazine about forming a gay men's music collective. And I wasn't really sure, you know, what I was going to do with it, but I was kind of putting feelers out there. And I did, in fact, meet a songwriter who I ended up collaborating with on a rock opera.
Who was that?
His name's Gene Porter, and we, in fact, wrote a rock opera that it was about the events in the late 70s, Anita Bryan's hate campaign and the election and then the subsequent murder of Harvey Milk in San Francisco. It sort of strung all those events together in a period of time. And I worked on that for a year or two, but what happened at the same time was that I met Paul Phillips that summer, not through the ad, ironically. We just met and we began dating, and it wasn't until about 6 months after we'd been going out that we actually started singing together, and he ended up being the one that I built a career with, of course.
Let's back up a step. I know you've told this story many times, but it's a great story. How did you and Paul meet?
Well, you have done your research. We met on the street by chance on one July day in Golden Gate Park, where I lived in the Sunset in San Francisco, and I was riding my bike through the park, actually, and I saw him, and I thought he was cute. And so we were just kind of, well, cruising each other. And in fact, he walked out of the park and was waiting at the bus stop for the bus. And I was kind of circling on my bike. And then he got on the bus, and I followed the bus on my bike for about a block. He got
That's
off at the,
pretty subtle.
He got off at the next stop. And then there was this awkward moment, like, now what do we do? You know, and we just started talking. And we spent the next 3 days together.
So you started dating. How did that lead up to performing together?
Paul, you know, right away he found out that I was a songwriter and that I, you know, knew that I was a musician. But he wasn't that impressed with anything I'd written so far until I wrote a song called Lost Emotions, which was, it's on our second album. And he really liked the song, and he asked me if he could try singing some harmony on it. This was like December 1982. And as soon as I heard the sound of our voices together and the harmonies that he created, I knew it was something special. I knew it was going to work, and I wanted to sing with him and create an act. And right around that time, there was a little club called the Valencia Rose, which was just opening in San Francisco, and they had a open mic for gay comedy on Monday nights, and I went down and talked to the owner, and I think he felt sorry for me, I don't know, And he said we could come in, even though we weren't doing comedy, we could come in and, you know, be like the musical break. So we started going there every Monday night just because there was no other place to perform and to try to do what we were doing in front of a supportive audience. That was the beginning of our career. We started to do funny songs eventually just to, you know, try to fit into the format there more. And in fact, we found that we were good at it, and then, you know, that led us further.
Did you write At the Rose then or much later? Or
At the Rose? No, that was written later, after the Valencia Rose was closed. Around the time we started, the only song that I had was, well, Lost Emotions, which I mentioned, and I had just written Homophobia, or I think Paul and I had written it together, yeah. And we used to sing that song every week.
How many songs did you do in an evening?
Oh, maybe 5 songs. We used to sing a couple of songs by the Roaches. I was really into that. We were both really into the music of the Roaches. You know, and their acoustic style and their vocal harmonies were a big influence on us.
So you did some cover songs, too.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty much mandatory for anybody.
Yeah. I think I was actually having kind of a dry spell in my writing then, so it was a year or two before I wrote some good songs that really fit into our act. I think the first songs were like The Prince Charming Tango and Outfield Blues, What Kind of Self-Respecting Faggot Am I? We started singing those songs there.
How did the cassette In the Outfield come about?
Well, we wanted to make a recording, and we didn't really have any money, and a friend who had a 4-track tape recorder, I think, volunteered to record us a couple of our performances. By that time, we had started doing concerts there, you know, at the Rose, you know, full concerts of just us, our own material. And we recorded a couple of those and used the best of that, put out an 8-song cassette, which, you know, we did it for just a few $100, just to try to get something started. And we actually sold about 1,000 copies of it on our tour. Yeah.
I was about to ask you how many you had pressed.
Yeah, not more than 1,000.
Wow.
And, you know, our first national tour was in the fall of 1983, and we sold the cassette, and the sound quality was pretty crummy, but the fact that it was obvious that people really wanted the material, and that really gave us the confidence to go further and borrow the money that we needed to make a record, which we did the next year.
There were about 3 songs on that cassette that didn't appear again.
Didn't appear again?
Yeah, that you didn't re-record later.
Uh-huh. Oh, on the cassette, yeah.
Yeah. Tell the Children was my favorite of those.
Tell the Children, yeah. There's a song called Mrs. Lockhart.
Uh-huh. And Circle Something.
Oh, Circle Around the Sun. Yeah. We didn't feel like those were the strongest ones. But yeah, we did record all the other ones over.
Okay, I want to get into the writing process. How did you write together? Did you do both words and music? Did Paul come in later and massage it, or what?
I tend to write lyrics first. I mean, I was the primary songwriter, and I probably wrote, 70 or 80% of our material. I don't think there was one song that Paul had no influence on, but basically what we used to say, I would write a song and then he would rewrite it. And he always managed to bring some extra musical trick, or he always had a way of improving my songs that just took them further, just took them over the top and made them really great songs, I think. We were a really good partnership in that way.
What did he add? Was it arrangement, or was it flair, or...?
Definitely arrangement. That's probably his strength. See, I am mostly self-taught as a musician, and Paul had a lot more musical training, was playing music and studying piano from the time he was a little kid. He was able to bring that knowledge to my sort of natural ability as a writer, I guess you could say. A lot of times he could tell when I was trying to, what I was trying to do musically in a particular style, and he would find ways to make it more in that style. I'm sure you've noticed that a lot of our songs are kind of musically eccentric and they're very stylized. And
I was going to ask how you end up writing so many different styles.
I listen to lots of different kinds of music, and it's really, I guess, how I study music. I listen to stuff, and then when I like it, I want to write something similar. I want to imitate it. That's where most of my inspiration comes, for the music. And lyrically, the inspiration just comes from things I'm interested in, things that make me angry, things that I find funny, things that I think need to be said, other people's stories that I think need to be told. Of course, we traveled so much those years, and we just spent a lot of time talking in the car or wherever we were about, if I had an idea for a song, we'd talk about the best way to make it into a song, the best way to say it, would it be a funny song, what humor can we mine out of this subject, etc.
Did you go for funny mostly, or...?
We went for funny a lot. We felt that that was one of the things our audience came to our shows for, as much as the political content, I think. that was one of the strengths of our act, was that we were pretty funny. And, yeah, I mean, we always tried to find a balance, but we found that for the live shows, we really needed to have a lot of funny songs.
Did people come up to you and say, why don't you write a song about such and such?
Oh, yeah. People suggested things. People wrote to us. There were times people even sent us lyrics that they'd written, or, you know, a few lines or a title maybe. That. And there were many suggestions that we used, actually. The song One of the Enemy from our Be Political, Not Polite album was suggested to me by the person that it was about, by a gay teacher. And, you know, I just tried to tell his story. I mean, he actually gave me the title. He said, you know, when I'm in the classroom and I can't talk about anything about gay rights, I feel like I have to pretend like I'm one of the enemy. You know, and I just used that.
I'm going to go through the albums and looking for, like, general comments about them, like about the production, what was going on that mm-hmm. might have influenced that album or in your lives and so forth. So we've heard about In the Outfield. Mm-hmm. Let's get into I Thought You'd Be Taller.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was our first real album. I didn't want to add a lot of production on that album because I wanted it to sound as close to our live performance as possible. I just wanted it to be enhanced, which in retrospect I'm not really sure was a great decision, because I think that the music probably could have benefited from a few more instruments and better production. I'd heard a lot of people who went to a producer and had somebody arrange their music and change it so much that they kind of lost the soul of their own intentions creatively, and I didn't want that to happen with us. So we produced that album basically ourselves. We went into a studio we'd never really recorded before, completely green, and fortunately the engineer kind of took a liking to us and appreciated the politics that we had and really tried to help us make a decent record. But we kept it pretty simple.
And for Trouble in Paradise, you enlisted Teresa Troll.
Yes, I remember it was our photographer, I think Irene Young, who suggested that we talk to Teresa. Teresa had just produced Deirdre McCalla's album, and which came out really nice. And I think Paul especially wanted to try hiring a producer to see what somebody else could do with our music to take it a little further. You know, we were starting to think about things like how can we be a little more slick and in order to get some more radio airplay, that sort of thing. We wanted higher production values. Actually, Trouble in Paradise was really exciting at first, because we got to work with a lot of great Bay Area musicians like Daryl Engel, Mike Marshall, Barbara Higbee, because they were all friends of Teresa's and people that she worked with a lot in the studio, so she brought them in. And they all did a fantastic job, and it was exciting to see our songs sort of grow up very quickly. But at the same time, I was really struggling with the fact that I wasn't playing the guitar only on two songs, I think, and that I had to kind of let go of that part of it. And so I think when the album came out, I actually was really, really disappointed in it, but then it got such a good response from our fans that eventually I had to admit that it really was, that she did a great job, and she brought out the humor in our songs, I think, by the kind of musical settings and the musical arrangements that she put them in. I mean, so much that I actually asked her to produce my solo album, which I did years later.
Okay, so then you didn't choose her on Emotional Roller Coaster.
Well, no, at that point I think I was still kind of not completely happy with how Trouble in Paradise had turned out. Well, one of the things that had bothered me on Trouble in Paradise was that there wasn't as much duet singing. You know, and I had felt like that our voices, our harmonies were like really the core of our sound, and I really was upset that there wasn't more of that on the record like there was on the first record. There were a lot more leads and solos, so I didn't want to work with her again on the next album. We used a friend, Marcy Dictorow, who just produced my friend Judy Fiel's album. We got on with her really well, and she seemed to understand what we were trying to do, so we did that album in Los Angeles. That was fun. It was we used a lot of string players, and there's some orchestral arrangements on the album that are really nice, and I got to play with the band on most of the songs. I feel like that album is actually one of the strongest albums in terms of the material, although I think the arrangements or the recording is a little sloppy on some of the tracks, but basically that album came out pretty well.
Oh, I think it did. So that was 88.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was a jump of 3 years to Be Political, Not Polite.
Mm-hmm.
Did it take more time? Was it a change in philosophy, or what was going on?
Boy, I'm not sure I remember. I think we decided that we had 3 albums under our belts, and we didn't need to rush, that our career was, we'd sort of established ourselves, and that we could maybe rest on our laurels for a little bit before making another album. Although we never we never stopped touring. I mean, we were always, every year we went out and did road tours that were 2 and 3 months in the fall and then a couple of months in the spring. And so we did keep very busy.
You toured about half the time, roughly?
Yeah. And we had moved here to Santa Fe, New Mexico, actually, just before Emotional Roller Coaster came out. And it was really nice to be able to spend the winter here, the winters and the summers here, just staying home. And Be Political, Not Polite, again, each album that we made, we've kept feeling like we're getting closer to the sound that we wanted, to the compromise between having other instruments, but also keeping some of the feel of our live performance of just the two of us. And I think on that album we really succeeded. We finally got it right. John Bacchino, who a lot of people know, of course, is Holly Near's accompanist. He's a fantastic piano player and musician and songwriter. We had become friends with him years before that. So he was very much, he knew our music very well, and we were very comfortable working with him. There was a really good kind of balance of creative power. And we spent an incredible amount of time arranging that album before we even went into the studio, because we used drum tracks and synthesized bass that John played, and that all of that had to be, you know, arranged and pre-programmed before we went into the studio. So we had really extensive rehearsals, and John didn't want to, you know, muddy up our voices or our guitar playing, you know, with a lot of other instruments. So we were very much in agreement on that. And that album, it took like 500 hours to make in the studio, which, if you know anything about making records, is really, really a lot for the kind of budgets that we had to work with.
And that was in Santa Fe?
We actually recorded it again in Southern California, a little studio in the San Fernando Valley. And we spent several months there working on it. I mean, it was just really, really meticulous. Every track took a long time. But we were really, really happy with how it came out. We felt like it had energy, but it also was very acoustic, and we liked it a lot. We tried to make up for the 3-year absence, too, by putting on a few extra songs. That album actually has 15 tracks on it.
Okay, then a year later, Hopeful Romantic, and this was a solo one. What was going on there?
I think the reason I wanted to make a solo album was because I had a lot of songs that I'd written that I didn't feel like quite fit into our act on stage, and more than we could put on any of our duet albums, meaning that they were serious songs, they were love songs. And throughout our career, I felt the pressure to write funny songs, which is really harder than writing something serious.
Humor is tricky.
It's very tricky, and I don't always feel funny, you know. But, you know, that was part of what our fans wanted from us, and we enjoyed it, but it was hard. And I wanted to be able to just do an album that wasn't so funny and not worry about it, and just something that was more musical. And I had found some old tapes of songs that I'd written, you know, earlier and that I hadn't finished, and before I had met Paul, that is. And I wanted to rework some of those and put them out there. I felt like it was just maybe sort of a part of me and my songwriting that needed a vehicle, you know, that was separate from what I did as Romanofsky and Phillips, and I just wanted to put it out into the world. And I did choose Teresa Troll to do that album, because by that time I was okay with, you know, not being one of the studio musicians, just being the songwriter and the singer and doing the album. I just really wanted the songs to be played as well as they could by good musicians. And so we had Bonnie Hayes on that album, and Daryl Anger again. And
wasn't John Bacchino on it?
And John played on the album. Teresa sang on the album too. I guess I was trying to make something closer to a pop album, and I was toying with the idea of performing solo a little bit. I think the only performance actually that I did by myself, though, was when the album came out. I played at the National Gay Press Association. I had a conference in San Francisco, and that was the one solo performance that I did during all of those years.
On to Brave Boys.
Brave Boys. Brave Boys, the lyric of that song was written by my friend Gene Porter, who I mentioned earlier, who I had met when I was trying to form the Gay Men's Music Collective and wrote the rock opera with. And Gene would just send me lyrics every once in a while when he wrote something. And Brave Boys was one of the lyrics that he sent me that I thought was a terrific lyric. It was written for some friends of ours, one of whom had died after battling AIDS for many years. And I loved the lyric, and I put it to music. And that's where that song came from. The album, of course, is an anthology, a compilation album of mostly of material from our previous records. And
but some recordings.
There are some new recordings. We did some updated versions of some of the songs, like Don't Use Your Penis for a Brain with updated lyrics, and Homophobia. We decided it would be fun to just do something different with the song, so we took it to a friend of ours here in Santa Fe, Jeff Nelson, who terrific bass player, and he also does a lot of, he plays a lot with rock bands, and he was doing a lot of rap music at the time. We thought it would be fun to do something just really outside of our, you know, comfort zone. And so he rearranged the song, and we did it as kind of a rap version, which looking back on it now, the only thing I would do differently is I wouldn't open the album with that, with that track.
I was going to ask, how was that received?
Well, you know, the reason we did that whole album and that song in particular is, again, we were thinking about radio airplay, and, you know, we really wanted to try to at least get some college radio airplay. And so we thought we'd try to come up with something, put it in the format that the radio stations would listen to, and we actually hired somebody to do radio promotion for a couple of months on that album. And it was tough. You know, this was like 94, yeah. And it was really right before gay comedy started to really break through into the mainstream. So we didn't really get the response that we'd hoped for.
And there was a CD single, too.
Yeah, that was we pressed that just to use as a promotional tool, I think, for the radio stations. That's probably actually what we sent them.
Was that the only CD single?
Yeah. But at that time, we were thinking a lot about how we might be able to sort of repackage ourselves and which material might be best received if we were trying to get some television exposure or radio, which we were working a lot with. We were trying to do a lot at that time. We had a manager who was giving us a lot of advice at that time, and I think a lot of it was her idea too.
Okay, the next all new material was Let's Flaunt It in 95.
Yeah. We had talked about doing a live album for many years because we felt that our live performance was really special, and the interaction that we have with our fans and the rapport that we have with our fans, and we wanted to capture that, you know, we wanted to capture that on a record. And we finally felt like we were ready to do it by that time because we felt like our performance was polished enough musically and as well as the, you know, the patter in between the songs. We were playing at this great little cabaret in Cathedral City. We used to play there a couple times a year, do like a weekend. So we scheduled these shows, and we thought, you know, it was kind of a last-minute decision. Why don't we just record these shows? And we'll, you know, we've already got the material arranged. It'll be really easy. And so that's what we did. And in fact, we also videotaped the shows too, hoping that we would release a live concert video, which we never actually were able to do. But the record came out... I thought it came out really well, came out pretty much what we wanted, and that was really the first one that we produced completely ourselves. I like the material on that album a lot. I think it does capture our stage performance pretty well, and I felt like the songs were as funny and provocative as some of our earlier material. I really like some of the songs on that album, like Homophobes in Robes and Island Song, and just, I think some of our best writing.
You sang a couple times about homophobia. As an act, did you experience it?
Yes, very much. In fact, we had a terrible problem with the Brave Boys album. And actually, it wasn't the first time we had problems with the manufacturer. I think it happened on with I Thought You'd Be Taller. There was a tape duplication plant. We'd taken them our master to have them manufacture it, and, you know, had a meeting with them, and everything was fine. They were really nice. And then we got a phone call a few days later, and they said that they, you know, after having heard the material, that they didn't want to reproduce it because they were a Christian-based organization or something like that, or the owner was. They were turning down the job. But then the worst thing was when Brave Boys came out, we had problems with two different, one was the printer and one was the color separator in the printing process. They sent the job back because they didn't want to print it because of some of the photographs and some of the material on the album, which, you know, the album has songs like If There Is a God, He's a Queen, and Homophobes in Robes, which talks about the Pope, and they didn't want to do the job. And then, that wasn't enough, so that delayed the release, which was financially difficult. And then when we finally got the album out, we had printed up a little postcard to send it out to our mailing list, which was about 10,000 names, and we depended really heavily on our mailing list and mail order sales to keep our business going. And the mail disappeared. We took it to the post office that had been posted, and it never got out to our fans.
Which album was that?
On Brave Boys. Yeah. So people didn't know about that album. And then we went out on the road and thought that everybody had already gotten the information about the album, and nobody knew about it. So that was pretty hard to recover from as a small business. But we never really found out for sure what happened, but it seemed pretty obvious that there was homophobia involved. It had the picture of the cover, which of course has both of us naked behind an accordion and a guitar. I mean, it's actually just funny, and it's not really risque when you compare to what else is out there. But somebody didn't like it.
What about the cover of Be Political, Not Polite?
That never bothered anybody. That never bothered anybody. We also had concerts that were picketed a couple of times by Christian fundamentalist organizations. One time in Orange County, and happened one time up in Oregon, I think. Yeah, Corvallis, Oregon. And I also, you know, we also ran into homophobia in the early days from, well, some of the most unlikely places. I mean, I remember one time talking to a publicist in L.A. who happened to be a lesbian. I guess she wasn't out. I don't remember. And at the time, you know, we were still pretty green, and I really wanted to talk to her and get some advice from, you know, a professional publicist about how we could improve our press kit and get better press. And she said, well, the first thing I would do is I wouldn't have the word gay in three letters in every page of your press kit. And I said, you just don't get it, do you? You know, that's what is special about our act. That's what people love about it. This is our selling point. This is not something we're gonna hide, you know, in small print. And but some people didn't get that in the beginning. It was just funny to encounter it from another gay person.
Being in the business so long, you became friends with a lot of my heroes. Can I get some comments on them? First one on my list is Chris Williamson.
Mm-hmm. The most amazing thing about Chris Williamson is how funny she is, because, you know, most of her music is more serious and beautiful, but she's not exactly known for... She's somebody who should write some more funny songs, because she's got a great sense of humor. And we did a couple of shows with Chris and Tret, and we always just had a blast hanging out with them before and after the show.
Alex Dobkin.
I love Alex. What I love about Alex is she's so uncompromising in her politics. She just cares passionately about gay and lesbian, about the gay and lesbian community. And she doesn't mince words, you know, and she's been out there as a lesbian songwriter and singer for so long, way before we were. And in fact, as far as the Heritage Award goes, I'm really very proud to be among her company in receiving the Heritage Award.
That's kind of how I got to know her last year. I interviewed her before that, and we've become kind of friends.
Yeah?
She's neat.
Yeah, she's great. We've had some really good discussions. I remember the first time we met her, you know, Alex had a reputation as being, or was, I guess, you know, a separatist for a few years. I mean, there was a point where she did concerts where, you know, men weren't allowed. And I guess she had heard about us and that we had pretty good politics and talked about women and lesbians in our act. And she came to see us at one of our shows in upstate New York somewhere. And I remember she came backstage and said hello, and she was really nice, and she really wanted to talk to us and get to know us. And we became friends immediately.
Michael Callen.
One of my regrets is that I never got to write a song with him, because he and I talked about it for a few years, but we never got around to it, because I never got to spend a whole lot of time with him. But he was really, really supportive of the work that Paul and I were doing, and I think he was one of the brightest lights in gay music that we had. And I'm really glad that the Legacy album came out, and that he was able to record so much of his music before he died. Because it's a real treasure. He's a very, very talented man. Extremely talented.
I've said many times he should be sainted.
Yeah, yeah. He was incredible. I mean, I don't know if I've ever met anybody who had that much strength. And he just kept going. He was so positive in his, you know, attitude. And also very humble at the same time.
How about Holly Near?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, Holly was one of my really earliest inspirations. In fact, I even predated my moving to San Francisco when I was a teenager. My older sister... had gone to hear Holly at a concert in my hometown of Pittsburgh, and that's actually where I first heard of her. I was probably maybe 16 years old. I think I actually wrote to Holly long before I ever met her, and telling her what I was wanting to do with gay music, and she wrote back a really sweet letter, and just totally encouraging me to go for it. I love her songwriting. I love her performance. I think she's one of the most powerful entertainers that I've ever seen. You know, one of the hardest things I think is to do a solo concert, you know, and I've seen her do concerts even without an accompanist, even without John, and she was incredible. So I'm really happy that I've had a chance to work with her and get to know her as a person, too.
Other than the people we just named, are there other gay lesbian artists that you were particularly close to?
Yes. You know who Charlie Murphy is?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Charlie Murphy released one of the first out gay albums. Catch the Fire, is that the title of it? Yeah.
Yes.
Catch the Fire came out in 1981, and it was right around the time that I met Paul, and that was all starting to happen. And, of course, I'd heard about him on an album called, from an album called Walls to Roses, which was an album of gay and straight feminist men, men's music that was put out in the 70s, and Charlie had a song on that album. And so we were all really excited when he did his own record, and, I think I met him at a party or something, and I invited him over, and he brought a copy of Catch the Fire with him, and so I got to listen to it with the artist for the first time, and he was great. You know, he sort of veered off in other directions eventually, but I always thought he was a terrific songwriter and musician. I don't know what he's doing now. Is he still doing anything?
I've not been able to find out.
Yeah.
I'd love to interview him, but I don't know where he is or if he would.
I'm trying to remember the name of his... He had a band. I probably have their record somewhere. I don't know. And another person I became real good friends with was Tom Wilson Weinberg.
How'd you meet him? Just touring?
I think I'd had his record, and so I knew of him. And then, I think we met at the 1983 Men and Masculinity Conference in Ann Arbor. Yeah. Paul and I performed at it, and it was one of the sort of springboards for our first national tour, because we met people from all over the country who then wanted to produce concerts for us. Anyway, Tom was there, and he performed, and... you know, our material and politics were so similar that,
oh, yes.
Of course, we got on really well. And Tom's just a great guy. I mean, he's a lot of fun to hang out with. And Paul and I stayed with he and his lover many, many times when we were visiting their town. And Tom and I had many, many conversations about songwriting and how we approached our art. I mean, he was really a wonderful colleague. We used to write a lot of letters back and forth. And we're still in touch. I hear from him occasionally.
I met him in 79. I was in a gay organization in Norfolk, and we brought him down for a conference, and he stayed at my condo, he and John.
Uh-huh.
So he probably was the first live gay artist I saw.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. We had talked about collaborating for many years, Tom and I. We tried it a couple times, didn't work, and then we finally, when I was making my solo album, I said, all right, I really, really, on this album, I really want to collaborate with a few other people besides Paul, just for variety, just for fun. And I really want us to do it this time. So the first two times we had tried it, where he would send me a lyric and I would set it to music, and it didn't come up with anything great. And then we tried it the other way. I wrote the lyric for the song called A Song in My Heart and sent it to him. And and in fact, he got it in the last minute. I mean, like, I was already in the studio recording the album, and he said, I'm just gonna sit down tomorrow and write it, and then I'll send it to you. And I got it in the mail, like, on a Wednesday, and, you know, like a lead sheet, not even a recording. And I recorded it, you know, like the next day or something.
Gee, he did a great job.
He did, and I think he was pretty pleased with how it came out with, too. I mean, we were both really happy that it came out. It's a good little track.
I know my listeners will be interested in your personal relationship. First you were lovers, then you weren't, on, off. Could you take us through that? You knew this was coming.
No, you don't want to go there.
You knew this was coming.
It's the tour of terror. It's not to the squeamish. we were lovers when we started. I mean, we met and we began dating even before we sang together. And we had many ups and downs. You know, what can I say? And at times I thought that it was because of the pressure of the act that was making it hard for us to be lovers personally. Other times I thought it was the act that really that was keeping us together. All in all, it was really wonderful to have that, to share that, you know, with a partner. I mean, we had a whole life, you know, we didn't just have a relationship, we had a whole life together. But I think one of the things is, I was very young when I met Paul, and I hadn't been out all that long, and I hadn't had that many relationships, I hadn't dated very much. I started getting a lot of attention from men, you know, because I was a performer, because I was out there, and so I began to stray, and in the summer of 85, yeah, like before we made Trouble in Paradise, we actually broke up for a few months, and, but then we got back together, did some more records, and a couple years later, we did decide to break up for good, and it was just really hard each time we broke up, because it was really hard for any new boyfriends that either one of us had, you know, because
you were together all the time.
Because we were together all the time. You know, we spent time together, but we also just, emotionally were very connected, you know, and it was just really hard to have new boyfriends. just really hard because of the intensity of our relationship. And also, you know, the creative process, I think, is so intimate, and it's when it's going well, you know, it has a feeling that is similar to me, similar to being in love. And so that was very confusing, and it took me a lot of years to sort that out. My feelings for Paul, my feelings for our career, my feelings for the music and my creativity. It was really hard, and, you know, just, we were very young, but we came through it all, you know, and in fact, the last few years before Paul left Santa Fe, we were actually living next door to each other. Two separate apartments, but next door to each other, and we both had other boyfriends, and we had finally kind of worked through it, so I'm glad that we did, and today we're still very, very close. We talk on the phone all the time.
How did the shift in the relationship affect your creativity? Harder, easier, more inspirational, or?
That's a good question. Well, like I was already saying, it made it more confusing, I think, because whenever we would get back together and do writing, it kind of felt like old times, like we were together again, and it was very hard to find the line between our personal relationship and our professional one. Probably because there really wasn't one. You know, that's why it was so hard for us to break up. We just really didn't know where one thing ended and the other started. You know, I don't know. I think that's probably pretty normal for couples who work together.
Being in a public relationship added stress.
Definitely added stress because a lot of our fans were disappointed that we broke up because they didn't want to see it. We had become role models.
The dreaded role models.
The dreaded role models. Not exactly inadvertently. I mean, we knew what was happening and we tried to accept the job, you know, but it's hard because we had to live our lives too. And sometimes people would come up to us and say things like, I'm so sorry that you broke up, you know, I would have preferred that you broke up the act and stayed together personally. And, you know, it just made us feel terrible, you know.
That's a no-win thing.
Yeah. And there were times where, you know, we just really didn't want to be together and we didn't want to go on stage together. But I think actually, in some ways, it made our comedy a little sharper. And especially in some of the songs about breaking up and songs like Guilt Trip, you know, sort of took on a new meaning.
So did some of your songs come true?
Some of them, you could say that. Some of them sort of came true, yeah. Because sometimes when I write a song, often, in fact, it's not completely what I'm going through. It's what I feel a little bit or what I imagine I might feel in the situation. So they're not always autobiographical, certainly. Sometimes they become autobiographical.
When did you two stop performing together?
Our last concert was in 1999, June. It was in Montana. We knew our career was winding down. We weren't really trying to book ourselves anymore. And, you know, we didn't know that it was our last concert at the time. But that's what it was. Yeah.
And currently, are you in a relationship or?
I'm seeing somebody.
Just dating.
Yeah, just dating. I live alone, and I really have come to the conclusion that's the best situation for me, at least right now. And I'm pretty happy. There's a lot less drama in that department of my life than there used to be, and that's good. That's good.
Okay, you performed for a while with Lynn Lavner around, I guess, 88. Uh-huh. Can you talk about that in a moment or so?
Sure. We met Lynn really early on, I think probably around 1984. A friend of mine called me and said, Ron, you gotta get down to the Valencia Rose. There's a girl who's doing your act. And so I went down to see Lynn and, she was writing and singing these great songs that were very similar in her approach, you know, songs. It was very, very queer and very funny. And, we got to be friends. And I think immediately started talking about the possibility of doing some double bills and then doing a whole tour. And then in 1986, I booked a tour for us on the West Coast with about 12 dates, and we did, we had a great time touring with her and her lover.
Was this the Leather and Lace tour?
It was the Leather and Lace tour. Yeah, it was really fun.
I interviewed her for my most recent show.
Uh-huh.
And she's very delightful. On the phone, I've never met her, but...
Oh, yeah, she's hilarious. I mean, what you see is what you get.